Welcome to the Caris Molecular Minute Podcast. I'm your host, Shadi Nabhan. I'm the chairman of the Precision Oncology Alliance at Caris Life Sciences. The Precision Oncology Alliance is this large collaborative research network composed of academic sites, universities, and healthcare systems, all of us focused on collaborating on big data research, AI, molecular profiling, with the ultimate goal of improving the outcomes of all patients diagnosed with cancer. Recently, the city of San Francisco had the ASCO GI 2024 meeting, where thousands of GI oncologists from across the country and the globe migrate to San Francisco to learn about novel GI oncology research, present their data, and discuss novel approaches and trials. And today's podcast is focused on some of the relevant clinical data that has been presented at the ASCO GI 2024 meeting. And I'm hosting Dr. Rashna Shroff, Professor and Chief of Oncology at the University of Arizona Comprehensive Cancer Center. Dr. Shroff also is the incoming Precision Oncology Alliance GI Working Group Chair, and her term will start in July 2024. We are going to talk a lot about some of the data at ASCO GI, but I think before I do this, it's really critical for me to share with you that back when I did my fellowship and training, there wasn't really anything going on of what we do in GI oncology today. We barely knew about microsatellite instability or mismatch repair genes. The debate was always, how do you give 5-fluorouracil? Do you give it bolus? Do you give it continuous infusion? Do you give it weekly, daily, all of these things? That's really what was the debate. And fast forward many years later, and right now we have a precise precision approach to various GI malignancies. And as you know, we recently launched the Caris Assure Innovative Liquid Biopsy. And with that, we're going to be able to apply this in some GI malignancies, as you will learn, where there's really a role for minimal residual disease or treatment selection and things of that nature, whether it is clinical or on the research side. So this field is really moving, and molecular profiling is front and center in GI oncology, as well as liquid biopsy. And with the presence of Caris Assure, I believe we're going to help a lot of patients diagnosed with various GI malignancies. With that said, without further ado, Dr. Rashna Shroff from University of Arizona on the Caris Molecular Minute Podcast. Rashna, welcome to the show. I really appreciate you taking the time of your busy schedule.
Thank you so much. I'm so delighted to be here. And I'm glad we were able to find the time to finally do this.
Yes, because I do know how stressed you are on time and schedule, given your research, administrative, and clinical responsibilities. So I promise you that you giving us some time does not go unnoticed. So thank you for that. Maybe a little bit about you, just, you know, what you do and in your various roles. And is there a story that led you to become a GI oncologist?
Sure. So as you mentioned, I am a GI medical oncologist. And actually, the story is rather funny because when I matched in fellowship, I ranked MD Anderson Cancer Center number one because my plan was to be a stem cell transplanter. And that was really just born out of the mentorship I had in residency. And then I met my mentor, one of my mentors, Dr. Bob Wolf, who was the fellowship program director at MD Anderson Cancer Center for 20 plus years, and was probably and is probably one of the best physicians and oncologists I've ever known in my life. And I did his clinics in pancreatic cancer. And I was like, no, this is what I want to do. So I totally pivoted, dropped hematology, just did oncology and focused on GI med onc, specifically pancreas and biliary at the time that I was at MD Anderson, and now really a little bit more pancreatic and hepatobiliary. And, you know, I really focus primarily in clinical and translational investigation, really trying to develop novel therapeutics, targeted therapies, and immunotherapy approaches for pancreas and biliary cancers. I was on faculty at Anderson for 8 years, and then I was recruited here to the University of Arizona Cancer Center to help build and grow their GI cancer research program on the clinical and translational side. So it's been a fun almost 6 years here of growing a GI cancer program here.
And you also have the administrative role, being chief of oncology. So congrats. I know this is maybe a year old now.
So I had the privilege of stepping in as an interim chief and getting my feet wet and understanding if I really wanted the job. And then I've been made permanent division chief of hematology oncology since the fall of 2023. It really kind of melds well with where my passion lies because I love the clinical research side of things, but I also really love mentoring and faculty development and growing and supporting, especially junior faculty. So it's kind of aligned with my why and my passion.
Well, that's wonderful. They're really lucky to have you in all of these roles at the University of Arizona. We recently all had the ASCO GI 2024 meeting. It's the pinnacle of GI oncologists, like the haven for GI oncologists right there in San Francisco. Clearly, there's a lot of data, and we can't really summarize all of it. I thought, I'll have you discuss some of the things that you just found interesting, important. Maybe either practice changing or close to practice changing. So, however you want to really start, and whichever area in the GI oncology area we can start talking about.
Absolutely. Yes. No, I had the privilege of serving as the program chair for ASCO GI 2024. We don't have the final numbers in, but word on the street is that it was the largest in attendance in the 21 years of it. And what I love about this meeting is that it's global and it's multidisciplinary. And I think that's what really separates the GI ASCO, GU ASCO from Big ASCO and some of the other meetings, and really is, I think, focused, like you mentioned, on what things are going to have clinical implications and that you're going to implement in your clinic starting that Monday after GI ASCO. And I think this year there was actually a fair amount of potentially practice-changing data along the entire GI tract. For me as a person who pays particular attention to the HPV day and that Friday, there was one huge study that everyone was waiting on, which was the EMERALD-1 study, which was in hepatocellular carcinoma and intermediate stage HCC, and looking at the idea of now that we've gotten better drugs and better therapeutics for advanced HCC, can we integrate this into a multimodality, multidisciplinary approach for liver-limited or intermediate stage hepatocellular carcinoma? So this was a large phase three study that basically looked at the combination of durvalumab with TACE plus or minus bevacizumab. And these patients were randomized to one of these three arms. Everybody got up to four treatments of TACE with durvalumab during that time period. And then after completion of TACE, either continued on placebo, durvalumab alone, or durvalumab with bevacizumab. And the study was powered to really look at the difference between the durvalumab bev arm versus the TACE plus placebo arm. And it was highly statistically significant in terms of progression-free survival. And that is the primary endpoint of PFS. We did not see OS data yet, probably because it's just the data is not mature enough yet. But, a significant improvement with a strikingly positive hazard ratio, some demonstrating that kind of component of Dorva Bev really may synergize with TACE to improve and delay progression. And importantly, the durvalumab plus TACE arm alone was not necessarily statistically significantly improved compared to the TACE alone. And so suggesting that that addition of bevacizumab, that anti-VEGF component, might really be important with the immunotherapy, which again, in the advanced HCC space, we somewhat know already. So, I think that is a study that is going to be really important and relevant. I will say, I was telling the PIs and the presenters that here in the States, we do a lot of radioembolization as
I
opposed
was
to.
going to tell you to for the non-GI oncologists, if you can tell us what TACE is, just so folks.
Yeah, sure. So TACE is transarterial chemoembolization, which is the idea of, using and accessing the hepatic arterial circulation, knowing that our HCCs are really typically well supplied by the arterial circulation, and delivering chemoembolization either sometimes in the form of beads or others. And so it's a direct kind of liver-directed treatment with chemo. That is compared to, say, transarterial radioembolization, which are radio-labeled, kind of delivering radio-labeled beads directly, sometimes usually with the yttrium-Y90 to the tumor as well. And so, in this day and age, TACE, I would say, is globally probably still the main modality of therapy. Here in the United States, we use probably in a lot of the larger centers, we probably use a little bit more radioembolization. And so, understanding how this could be practice changing, but still something that is relevant to our clinical practice, I think remains to be seen a little bit.
So, but your sense from this trial is that you await overall survival changes, or you feel it's almost there, like this is sufficient data where you might start implementing in practice?
No, I think this is a practice-changing study, and that's because for those of us who treat hepatocellular carcinoma, we know that delaying progression is actually a really clinically meaningful endpoint because these patients typically have underlying cirrhosis, they don't have great liver function at baseline, and as the HCC kind of starts to take over the remaining liver parenchyma, it can really cause not just morbidity, but mortality in these patients. And so being able to delay that progression is a really important endpoint and can sometimes be a surrogate marker for other important efficacy data. I do think the overall survival data will, of course, be important, but I think it is something that will make us think that the multimodality approach is something we need to think through. And again, how we integrate our current practice patterns remains to be seen, but I do think it's practice changing.
And Rachna, before I move to the next abstract, just a quick question. How have you seen TACE in a community practice in general or community hospitals? It sounds from listening to you that this is a rather more sophisticated way of approaching the liver. Is this something that is becoming more mainstream in non-academic, non-university type practices?
Yeah, I do think that, liver-directed therapies as a whole, whether it be TACE or TARE or other, things like cryoablation, radiofrequency ablation, I think those things are more becoming seen more in the community. That being said, as we design trials, a lot of us, especially even on the NCI Hepatobiliary Task Force and such, we discuss about the question of quality assurance and how do we really know, like for instance with radioembolization, that the actual dosimetry and the amount of radiation that's being delivered is really standardized across the board. Similar with TACE, when you do the arterial mapping, different sets of eyes look at the ability to deliver the chemo differently. And I think those are things that make, like I said, that kind of standardization of it a little bit more difficult, and I think is why the larger tertiary care centers are still huge referral bases for these types of approaches. And interventional radiologists at those centers are really skilled and do large volumes and are able to kind of really have that QA component, that quality assurance component.
Great. Let's move on to some other data.
Yeah. So I think the other kind of an interesting space was in the data that looked at in the upper GI space looked at whether or not we can and should build on in immunotherapy. As we know, chemotherapy and immunotherapy is really becoming more and more standard in esophageal and upper GI malignancies. And there was a study that came out that was done, primarily in Asia, which is where upper GI malignancies are probably more predominant. It looked at esophageal squamous cell carcinoma and looked at the combination of chemotherapy with immunotherapy and with or without an anti-TIGIT. And, anti-TIGIT is, again, another immunomodulatory approach that we've started to look at in combinations with our traditional checkpoint inhibitors in a lot of different cancers. And so this was a study that demonstrated that looked at a taxane and platinum-based chemotherapy with immunotherapy with the addition of an anti-TIGIT. And again, this was specifically in esophageal squamous cell carcinomas, which are not necessarily that common here in the United States, but are, globally at least, a very large problem. And the data really suggests that we can and should be building on, a chemo backbone with immunotherapy combinations. And so this study, again, I think in addition to one other study, which I'll get to in just a second, is showing that immunotherapy really needs to be a part and parcel of our approach to patients with upper GI cancers. Interestingly, in this study, because there's a lot of roaring debate about the importance of PD-L1 positivity and CPS
I was
scores,
just going to ask you that, actually.
and whether or not the higher the CPS score, the better the effect of the immunotherapy component. And at least in the data that was presented in this, admittedly, all I believe Japanese patient population, the benefit of the anti-TIGIT addition to the immunotherapy, to the checkpoint and chemotherapy, was across all PD-L1 subgroups, so regardless of PD-L1 positivity. Again, I always try to remind myself that we do know that the immune profile of Western and Asian patients tends to be different across a lot of different cancers. And so, whether or not that PD-L1 component is relevant in an American population, I think remains to be seen.
All
But
of these patients are advanced stage, right? We're talking about advanced stage disease.
correct. That was this is an advanced. But that's what I was going to say is the counterpoint to that was the Skyscraper data, which also came out that looked at perioperative FLOT with which is a standard approach in GE junction and gastric patients. Fluorouracil, oxaliplatin, and taxotere in combination with durvalumab. And so again, can we build on a chemo backbone and add in immunotherapy and actually make a difference? Some of the initial data for this was actually presented at ESMO. And now Dr. Janjigian presented kind of some updates looking at pathologic complete response rates and things like that. And what we're seeing as we see this data again mature, because recurrence-free survival is obviously an important endpoint, but at the end of the day, are we impacting overall survival? I think is the remaining question. But importantly, it was safe. FLOT is not an easy regimen, so building on FLOT was always question number one. And then question number two is, does the immunotherapy improve pathologic complete response and recurrence-free survival? And so far, the data is saying that it is suggesting that it does. And I think we need more follow-up to really understand, like you mentioned, does PD-L1 positivity matter? Does overall survival get impacted by these types of things? Because FLOT alone is a great perioperative approach, and we need to see if by adding something, we're really changing overall outcomes for these patients.
And when you say perioperative, most folks are undergoing this as a neoadjuvant therapy before surgery. And then after surgery, do you continue treatment as well, or we still don't know if you have a pathologic response, I mean?
And that's I think a hotly debated issue. A lot of patients, especially FLOT, it's hard to tolerate FLOT after these types of surgeries. And that these are the real world issues that we deal with that I are and these really well beautifully designed studies, when you translate it to clinical applicability, I think those are the big questions that come up. But I think in general in the upper GI space, what I think I'm learning at least, and I don't actively see these patients every day, but is that immunotherapy clearly needs to play a role in the treatment approaches for these patients.
And I mean, it's not far-fetched to think in the future that potentially chemotherapy will be, we may not need everything we're doing with chemotherapy. You commented on FLOT, how difficult it is, and you wonder whether there's a future state where we have less chemotherapy, more of the IO and target therapy. Who knows?
Absolutely. I was going to say the other big area of interest remains ctDNA. You can't talk, I feel like you can't talk about GI cancers without talking about DNA nowadays. And again, obviously, the disease site that's probably furthest along in this is colorectal cancer, and understanding the role of it in surveillance, minimal residual disease, adjuvant therapy. I was really proud to see my dear friend Van Morris present the data from COBRA, which was the NRG study that looked at the use of ctDNA and the Guardant-based technology specifically for determination of in resected colorectal cancer patients, the determination of the adjuvant therapy and the whether or not to give and or using it to monitor. And then there was, of course, the CIRCULATE data that came out that looked at updated data with the idea of minimal residual disease and the Signatera platform. I'm not going to comment specifically on each of the specifics, but what I will say is I think this field is really evolving. It's really interesting to me to see the technologies and the way and the speed and the rapidity with which it's just they're getting more and more fine-tuned, and they're able to really demonstrate potential utility of how we can use the idea of circulating tumor DNA and minimal and quantifying minimal residual disease and have that drive therapeutic choices. I will say, I think that as the data increases, I'm feeling a little bit more and more comfortable. I think in some ways, sometimes we rush and we put the cart ahead of the horse, and I think it'll be important for us to really see as more data gathers what we're doing in terms of, are we sparing people therapies? Are we improving quality of life? I mean, the patient-reported outcome and quality of life component of all of this, I think, is going to be really important.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, the reality is, I mean, we know in the adjuvant setting, anytime you give adjuvant therapy, by default, adjuvant treatment, we're over-treating people. We're over-treating a population to cure a minority of patients. We know that. We know we over-treat with adjuvant therapy. Would be wonderful as we evolve into a space where we know exactly where we can de-escalate therapy and escalate therapy and so on. And so, you know, I think the value of liquid biopsy is going to be increasing in pretty much all solid tumors. But in colorectal, it seems like it's, you know, the data is a little bit more mature than others.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think the other really fun thing, and if I, you know, if we want to talk about the program as a whole, that I really loved, you know, there was previously these sessions that were cross tumors, tumor agnostic, if you will, and we called them, we branded them this year as called the intersection sessions. And so there was one intersection session every day. And like I said, the idea was to pick themes that are really important and relevant in the treatment of GI cancers, and to not necessarily make it about colorectal or hepatobiliary or upper GI. And so there was three themes that we chose this year. One was artificial intelligence. One was the approach to oligometastatic disease. And then one was just novel clinical trial designs and, you know, how we can think outside of the box and get drugs to patients faster. And so far, at least the feedback that I've heard, I mean, I attended them. I thought they were really fantastic and engaging sessions because these are the things, again, that, you know, the questions that we face in clinic. You know, we're getting better with drugs. And now, not just in colorectal cancer, but even in things like pancreatic cancer, we're having these oligometastatic patients that you start to think, well, should I be doing something different? I know historically metastatic pancreas cancer is metastatic pancreas cancer, and you don't take local therapy approaches or surgical approaches. And so as we start to think that we are getting better from a therapeutic standpoint, I think these types of sessions are going to be really important because you need that multidisciplinary engagement to think through the and develop and design data that supports our approaches. But, you know, I think even in the drug development space, the traditional large randomized global phase three trials, they're important, don't get me wrong. But when we have something that we want to try to get to our patients faster, you know, how can we think through what the right design is of a clinical trial to ask the important questions, understand the important toxicities, but then hopefully get it out to the community and to the patients faster, you know. So I really enjoyed all of those sessions, and you know, I think hopefully moving forward, GIASCO will continue these that are, like I said, a little bit more tumor agnostic, but still really important practice.
That'd be great. And I mean, artificial intelligence is something that I'm intrigued with, and you know, at Caris, as you know, we're doing a lot of this work on artificial intelligence, mining the data set, trying to identify signatures. So it would be wonderful to actually not only understand the technology, how you do it, but also I always feel like separating the signal from the noise, right? I mean, it's a term that a lot of people are use, AI, but I think there are a few people to understand the details of it. So I'm glad that you shared this. And drug and trial design is so important. I mean, I've often said that sometimes I feel randomized controlled trials are a little bit too biased. I'm not saying we clearly need them, don't get me wrong, or changing standard of care. But why I say they're sometimes too biased, because you're really picking patients that fit stringent exclusion-inclusion criteria that doesn't always match what you're seeing in the real world, you know? So there must be a way to do this, and, you know, would be interesting to see what the progress there.
And you know, even the FDA, right, to your point about picking the right patients, you know, they're acknowledging that the other thing that we're totally missing out on is the diversity of patients in these involved trials. And, you know, how do we get more underrepresented in populations? Because, you know, how these patients respond to these drugs might be different in certain subsets of you know, a more diverse patient population. So
I recently taped a podcast with Dr. Ishwarya Subbiah, who is currently at Sarah Cannon, who's a colleague of yours and I, but And what we talked about is the equity in clinical trial, but actually she has a different lens, because a lot of times folks focus on equity in clinical trials based on race and ethnicity. But what she was telling me is, does it really matter if, let's say, you live 100 miles away from where the clinical trial is? This is really affects everybody. It doesn't really matter who the person is and where they are. You need to find ways to actually make it accessible, because that's how you're going to get equity. I found this pretty innovative and really a fresh look at things. And so I appreciate you mentioning this. Rachna, I know we're short on time, but anything in pancreas? I know you live in that. I mean, there's so many things. And anything you've seen this year in pancreas?
You know, I mean, there was a lot of really great sessions in pancreas, and, you know, specifically in things like KRAS targeting. There was a great session talking about, you know, how we're finally at the tip of the iceberg, I think, in terms of KRAS targeting therapies and approaches, which, of course, in the pancreas world is a very relevant target. I would say that some of the more interesting areas right now, and it actually was just perfectly timed with GI ASCO, was, you know, data related to some of these vaccine-based approaches, both in the adjuvant space as well as even in the, you know, more advanced pancreas cancer space. Again, either KRAS targeting vaccines or, you know, adjuvant approaches based on peptide-based vaccines. And so I think that's where a lot of the excitement and buzz was. You know, I don't know that there was any sort of quote unquote practice changing data that was presented at GI ASCO in particular. But like I said, I think a lot of interest in these specific targets and these specific niches that are very relevant to pancreatic cancer.
Well, I couldn't be more thankful for you to spending time with us. I know how cramped your schedule is, so I fulfilled my promise. I did not keep you more than 30 minutes, so which means you're going to accept future invites and come on the show. Now
Absolutely.
That I proved myself, I'll stick to time, right?
Absolutely.
Well, the one and only Dr. Rachna Shroff, professor and chief of oncology at the University of Arizona. Thank you so much for coming on the Caris Molecular Minute podcast.
Thank you so much.
Okay, folks, thank you so much for listening. If you like this show, don't forget to subscribe to it, rate it, and write a brief review. Let me know about topics or guests you would like to see or listen to on the show. Special thanks to Dr. Rachna Shroff from the University of Arizona for spending time with us from her busy schedule and talking to us about data from the ASCO GI 2024 meeting. Until next time, take care.